This is the definitive case against Hope Not Hate. It's not uncommon for organisations to use the pretense of anti-fascism to go about behaviours that would resemble fascism. A lot of people have been targeted by this organisation as private citizens and had their information shared with a malicious intent to deprive them of a means of making a living or indeed to cause them harm by way of exposure to that information. If they can't get anything to stick in the criminal realm or the civil realm of regulatory law, they will come after you by creating a dossier about you, by finding anybody that you've lived near, any ex-girlfriend you've got, ex-employer, who knows, find a complete dossier and attempt to prevent you from ever even entering public life before a sanction is brought against you. Blackmail, harassment, intimidation of people, sharing somebody's private information, their address, attempting to get them fired, posing as investigative journalists, sometimes posing as authorities to extract information. This is the thing that I think leads most observers, once they discover it, to think this is quite Secret Service type activity. This isn't the work of charities. And this seemed to me to be behaviour that, to anyone observing's mind, resembles closer that of the Gestapo rather than that of an anti-fascist organisation. They already have supporters in powerful places who are acting in very similar ways, one of which being the Attorney General.
Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. I have a very interesting guest for you today, and that is the lawyer, Mr. Michael Rayners. And he came to my attention because he wrote, he co-wrote, a fascinating article on the website Restorationist called How Long Can the CPS, for Americans, that's the Crown Prosecution Service, Ignore the Criminality of Hope Not Hate. Now, as viewers may know, Hope Not Hate present themselves as this fine, moral, upstanding, anti-racist, anti-extremism organization. What can you possibly have to criticize about such moral paragons? But it seems there may be a great deal, and this article has set this out in some depth. So, Michael, hello.
Hello, and thank you for having me, Mr. Dutton. A pleasure to be here, and a pleasure to be talking about this piece, which what was prompted to me is a lot of people who had attempted to say, as I see it, to be ordinary things, have been targeted by this organisation as private citizens and had their information shared frequently, largely known as doxing, with a malicious intent to deprive them of a means of making a living or indeed to cause them harm by way of exposure to that information. Now, I came upon Hope Not Hate's activities in this regard, looking into the laws surrounding doxing, which is perfectly legal in this country. Whilst so many parts of our speech landscape are very restrictive, some of the most restrictive that you would find in a liberal democracy or anywhere that would dare call itself one, doxing is a complete grey area. And that's really how I came upon Hope Not Hate, because, of course, sharing somebody's private information, their address, attempting to get them fired, these aren't generally things that you would consider to be pro-social activities. And they seem to be coming up an awful lot from this organization, Hope Not Hate. So after some collaboration with my co-author of this piece, we decided that it would be a wise thing to do to catalogue that and their various other activities, some alleged, some with credible sources to back up, which include blackmail, harassment, getting in touch with ex-girlfriends, neighbors, all kinds of color of things to discredit the man, not the idea, generally speaking. And this seemed to be laser-focused at people who, in no regards to my mind, struck me as anywhere in the realm of extremism. Largely the sort of things that the internet has provided the ability to make an income talking about, or are controversial issues that are not in discussion in Parliament or other annals of state. And they would target these specific people, ideally if they were anonymous, and then try and cause them significant harm, personal and financial and reputational, by doing so. And this seemed to me to be behaviour that, to anyone observing's mind, resembles closer that of the Gestapo rather than that of an anti-fascist organisation. It's not uncommon, though, for organisations to use the pretense of anti-fascism to go about behaviours that would, in a normal observer's mind, resemble fascism, the obvious one being Antifa and whatnot, essentially using anti-fascism as a guise to conduct Weimar-era street thuggery. Whereas Hope Not Hate struck me as becoming ebbing into the white collar variant of that. So that was really what prompted me to approach this piece and Alex with me to put this together.
Yeah. One of the things that they present themselves as being is an anti-extremism organization, which you note in the article, there's something beautifully English about anti-extremism. We don't vote for extremist parties. We don't have like a far right intellectual tradition or whatever like the French, but we tolerate their presence. And we tolerate the presence of the eccentric. We are, in a sense, a pro-eccentric nation, perhaps. And this is repressing the eccentric, and that also therefore represses the good eccentric, you know, the genius, because that kind of person will question the system and whatever. So it's quite bad for a functioning democracy that wants to achieve things.
Yes, I mentioned in the article that it is, generally speaking, an un-English thing to ensure that the eccentric is no longer able to thrive in this country. And you know quite correctly that the Europeans are wilder in their traditions of these kinds, and they do often end up in frontline politics, whereas that is not typically the situation here. For some context on Hope Not Hate's history, it emerged out of a 60s publication, Searchlight, but it's around the 90s when Lowles, as a co-editor of Searchlight, an anti-fascist magazine, became quite fixated on preventing the BNP's rise, and that is what led to the creation of Hope Not Hate. Initially, it used titles and was listed both, its various wings were listed as anti-BNP things briefly, and their concern was very much with that rise at the time, and a European-style frontline of more hard right, you might say, politics, or at least nationalist politics. But it has far exceeded that purpose, in my view, and is now entering the realm of simply, as you put it, making sure that the genius or the eccentric, or you know, whichever end of the IQ spectrum that eccentric falls on, ensuring that he can never find a place in public life of any kind, which is a serious problem. Because at that point, we're just sort of trundling on, bound together only by masking tape and regulation. And that's something I'm particularly concerned with.
It creates a climate of fear, I think, which is antithetical to innovation.
A total chilling effect on speech. And to put it here, to express how constrictive speech landscape is, you've got things that I've written on, for example, the Public Order Act and now the Online Safety Act of 2023. Between them, that it intends to criminalise, using a 1980s piece of legislation, any speech online that is other than wholly positive speech in the realm of anything to do with ethnicity or race. And that is now being extended to religion as well, which there has been some private members' bills tabled in Parliament about altering that aspect. But the Public Order Act has its fingers in lots of pies of that variety. And this is the realm of criminal speech. And we've seen that in the way the Attorney General signed off on 19, I believe, Section 19, offences under the Public Order Act, including Lucy Connolly, the most prolific example. That section is very rarely used. It's used usually once a year, if at all. And in summer of last year, to my know-how, about 19 people were done under it, and several thousand likely under Section 4 and 4A. So that's the realm of criminal speech that has been said. Then you've got the Online Safety Act, which attempts to utilise Ofcom, created in 2003, to regulate out of existence various sites on the British internet, on what is accessible here. So that's the sort of pre-crime element of speech. And then shy of those criminal thresholds, you have the non-crime hate incident. People like Alison Pearson have done very good work talking about that, and even may have had one listed against her, which through pressure has been taken away. But below all of that, below the realm of criminal conduct, you then have professional conduct via the several hundred regulators for every profession that exist in public life. These are largely a creation, or at least legislated into being and given force in the last 30 years, Blairite creations. And they are now ebbing into the realm of saying, well, the FCA, the Financial Conduct Authority, doesn't just regulate financial conduct, but also your personal conduct and speech, if you're going to exist in that field. The same with my own regulator, the same with anyone from a low-skilled care worker up, all the way to MPs. There is a regulator to what you can and can't do in public life. And failing anything on that even lower threshold, then there is hope, not hate. Who, if they can't get anything to stick in the criminal realm or the civil realm of regulatory law, they will come after you by creating a dossier about you, by finding anybody that you've lived near and perhaps had some kind of altercation with, verbal or otherwise. Any ex-girlfriend you've got, ex-employer, who knows? Find a complete dossier and attempt to prevent you from ever even entering public life before a sanction is brought against you. Now, this may be a seemingly quite bleak layout of what Britain's speech landscape and political conduct landscape is like. But Hope Not Hate is attempting to do something below even a non-crime hate incident.
This is very interesting in the sense that these people have contacts with people that are seriously powerful.
These implications of that.
They have the backing of members of parliament. They have the fact that, for example, as I uncovered, Harold Shuckman, who was the author of this book, The Year of the Rat? At least he is self-aware. Where you know he infiltrated various groups, and I remember I was very frustrated by it because I sat on an online discussion with him, which was in the TV program about this, and I was blurred out. In the, you can see that my colleague there and me and my secretary are blurred out, and we were brought on to our purpose in being there was actually to give advice as to whether we thought he was some kind of infiltrator, and I said I think he is, and so and my female colleague said he has weak man vibes. And therefore is almost certainly right. Not on our side. He's a weak, you know, possibly you know, effeminate man, and which is consistent with being left wing in the data. And I also, when I first met him, the first thing he said to me, he said, "Can I have a selfie?" And I said, "All right." And then he said, "How many people do I think was killed in the Holocaust?"
But that seems like a strange line of questioning for someone you've just met.
Like, and I thought to myself, you are either an undercover spy, or you're a bit mental, and we get mentals, you know, in groups like this. So my first conclusion was you're just a bit mental, but then I gradually realised but nobody listened to me because of the allure of the money he was offering and things like this. But you wrote a lot about his activities, you know, kind of essentially bribing people.
Yes, so Section 21 of the Theft Act concerns bribery and blackmail, and there seems to have been a consistent pattern from people I've spoken to and things that have found their way into that article secondhand, not just from Shuckman specifically, that the threat of a dossier finding its way to employers and potentially leading to criminal or regulatory sanction, or the offer of money, appears to be a consistent theme in the interactions coming out of, not directly from Hope Not Hate, but people who have certainly been associated with them. And any organization operating as an arm of a charitable organization doing that sort of thing should be brought to the attention of the Charities Commission immediately. There's always this separation of powers that allows for quite a variety of charities to have a political arm of some form, where they're not supposed to engage in strictly partisan behavior. However, they are in some ways insulated from losing charitable status if they have different governance. Now, part of the point of this whole piece was that, well, clearly the political arm here shares governance with the charitable part and is engaging in what appears to be a pattern of criminal behavior of a kind that, well, it shouldn't even come into question about the partisanship, but I believe the partisanship has led them to do this sort of thing, believing that it is for this greater good cause of anti-fascism. And that is highly concerning because what we've got is a self-appointed regulator of political action operating like a non-sanctioned intelligence agency for the purposes, as you've just described with your own experience there, of immediately discrediting people and attempting to smear them in a way that will deny them entry to public life or indeed simply cause them personal harm, financial or otherwise. And I don't lay the blame at any particular individual's feet in the organization. It is more so much a concern for an organization that is funded in those ways that it should continue to receive an allowance from the Charities Commission, again, a sort of Blairite creation, but to continue doing this in a partisan way. I'm rambling a bit there, but I'm being careful with what I say rather than making claims in the ether. But I do direct people to the article for what is now quite a fact-checked thing, and we've written this quite a few months ago now, to ensure that we're cautious about what we say, because they are a highly litigious entity as well.
Yes. So what this seems to be then, as far as I can see, is an extra legal arm, as I see it, of a kind of Blairite state. So you can't get them legal. It reminds me, the nearest comparison I can think of is the Republic of Ireland, when it was kind of de facto ruled by the church and by John Charles, what was the surname? I always get it wrong, McLeod or something. And he was the Bishop of Dublin. And they're basically groups of thugs. And if you criticized the Catholic Church, they would come around and intimidate you into not doing so. But Ireland's legal system was sufficiently reasonable that you still had freedom of speech and this sort of thing. But they didn't want that. And so you just have these intimidating people to end something which exists
in extrajudicial chilling of speech, basically. It seems like a perfect parallel from what you're describing there. I'm not familiar with that that historical parallel, but an extrajudicial chiller of speech is a good description of what Hope Not Hate has morphed into. Now, we need, I'm a great proponent of freedom of speech, and in its quite, I wouldn't say extreme, but its maximal form. And I don't believe that Nick Lowles and anyone else involved in Hope Not Hate should be prevented from saying as they please. But currently, we already have plenty of restriction on things that would ebb into the criminal or ebb into the inappropriate in professional context. Plenty of that. All of which largely amped up after the election of Tony Blair in 1997 and baked in through various quangos, about 500 of them we're at now, nearly 600. There's plenty of protection in the realm of law and non-criminal law too, without a group of thugs essentially doing the extra legwork. There's over protection without Hope Not Hate performing that role, as you have just described in Ireland.
Well, that's what
therefore I cannot see a justification.
They want to have that. But the dangerous thing is the association with assets of the state. I mean, how could this man, Harry Shukman, one of two things happened, this fellow, for people that aren't familiar with it, who infiltrated various English conservative, or they would say far-right groups, the Basket Weavers was one.
Weavers seemed to me, from my understanding, to simply be a decentralised social group.
Yeah, but it has, as it were, based or red-pilled or whatever beliefs. And that's what they're concerned about. And I also think they just don't like the idea of people having fun. I think they're just very unhappy people. And the idea of other people that don't agree with them having fun is horrible to them.
As with the regulatory framework, though, and that the basket weavers being a great example, it seems there is a desire to destroy terrestrial communities in any meaningful way, both on the legal ebb of this stuff, with regulating the humanity out of most professions all the way up and down the professional gamut, and then also preventing people from just getting together in the pub and having a conversation to the best of their ability outside of that. It seems that all of this is quite averse to life in England, as I personally know it, but perhaps I've been misinformed and there is antisocial thing that we now must pursue.
I did a video a while ago on the smoking ban, and then they talked about banning smoking outside pubs, not just in them, but outside pubs.
Of course, yeah, that was mentioned last year, I believe.
And I thought to myself, what is the point of that, other than the belief that pubs, if you are an authoritarian like Keir Starmer, pubs are dangerous. Pubs are where, when you're restricted in what you can publish, where you're restricted in what you can say online, pubs are where the ordinary man can get together with the other ordinary man and realize that there is dissent against the regime, and thus this will perpetuate a sense of confidence in the opposition, and thus further dissent. It is not good for an authoritarian regime that people can meet up and talk.
In a way that can't be immediately documented and utilized in a way that can be dossiered later.
Yes, exactly.
The pubs are extremely threatening in that regard, because normal life occurs in pubs, and authoritarians are terrified of normal life occurring uninterrupted. Nothing is more a threat to them than the natural order of things.
Exactly. But with regard to Schuckmann's passport, is it possible that he just changed his name by deed poll and managed to get a new passport?
It is possible that he could have done it that way, or he simply just got a forged document, which engages all the appropriate criminal sanctions of using that. But to use it to gain entry to... This is part of the basket weaver stuff, then. He assumed an identity, as far as I'm aware, and had a passport to back it up, a fake job to go with it, all of that. But that is criminal conduct, whether he forged it or whether he... It's possible he could have deed-polled it. But usually that would take a bit of time, and they would have had to have been planning it for a while. If it's a forgery, it's a criminal offence. And if it's via some other means, then, of course, that raises the alarm of where are they getting these things? Do they have ties to the state that are more formal than simply advising parliamentary committees, lobbying MPs that they have who are sympathetic, and having an attorney general who is a both pro bono advisor and also a member? The attorney general, of course, being Homer at the moment, responsible for signing off on much of the conviction spree from last summer, on online speech, including Lucy Connolly, all of that would have to have his say-so and sign-off. That's meant to be a stopgap for free speech cases when Section 19 of the Public Order Act is used. Of course, sign them off in droves, likely to support his personal friend Keir Starmer in his hard-on-crime rerunning of the 2011 riots. But the other thing is that this is somebody who Searchlight themselves congratulated on the appointment of, saying, oh, a former associate of ours who gave us legal advice is now the Attorney General. Brilliant. Searchlight being the precursor to Hope Not Hate. And then his own Wikipedia stands unedited that he was a patron and an early member of the organisation. So when it comes to links to the state, I'm less inclined to leap in on these people are James Bond, but without our own national interest at heart. Rather, they already have supporters in powerful places who are acting in very similar ways, one of which being the Attorney General.
Right, okay. And so that's a potential, we don't know, that could be, it could be a deed poll, we don't know. It's hard to say.
On the short point, yeah.
What was interesting about it, though, and what I found strange, is if you were going to adopt a new identity, I checked his details, this Schuckmann guy, he was born on the date the passport says, in the place the passport says, which is Plowley, Oxfordshire. It's just everything was correct, except the name was Chris Morton rather than Harold Schuckmann. So I wonder if that implies consistency with Depot. I don't know, that all the details are the same.
It lends some credibility to that, yes. But still, it's the entering somewhere deceptively and deliberately doing so for the purposes of maliciously sharing information, for basically discrediting and libeling the people involved. This isn't the work of charities. This isn't what the public thinks of when they think of as charities. And I know the public has an unusually rosy view of charities, despite Oxfam and its cocaine and hookers type expenditure. The public has a generally rosy view of charities, and to say, I'll give all the money to charity, is always a big green flag. But even within that rosy view, this is not the behavior of a charity, nor is it particularly offering a charitable service. This is possibly fraudulently acquired hit pieces on private citizens.
I never have any time. I'm extremely disorganized. Things basically overwhelm me. I don't know why this is. It's probably some sort of genetic thing. I'm basically present-oriented, a fast life history strategist. I really should find out more. And in order to do so, I should probably read this book, Blueprint, by Robert Plomin. It's a fantastic book, and it looks at the genetics of our psychology, the genetic reasons why we have the kind of personalities we have, why we have the kind of intelligence we have. Maybe that would help me make sense of why I'm like I am. I should read that book. But the problem is, as we've established, I never have any time. So I don't really see how I can read it. Or so I thought, until I discovered Legion.com. What Legion.com does is it takes the most basic and interesting books, including Blueprint by Robert Plomin, and it summarizes them into just 25 minutes, and then it allows you to listen to those books. That's my problem solved. Legion.com. And if you sign up today with the code TJH, then you will get 10% off. Legion.com. All the base knowledge from your phone straight into your brains.
But presumably they get round that, and this is the brilliance of them, that they skirt the law by saying there is the charity,
yes,
and then there is a separate entity which is the sole beneficiary of the charity.
The political arm of it, yes.
Yeah.
They're campaigning
on. It's legally separate. Is it not?
Well, yes. However, the Charity Commission themselves, upon an earlier report, far earlier than any of my writing on the subject, had recommended them to perhaps think about their governance being different people for both of those arms, because presently it's the same people. They were advised that in however sterner terms and have done nothing about it, which is why the open letter that came this week following my article is appropriate. And I believe that that has not been acted upon. And there is very little separation of powers. There's not exactly a sort of internal firewall going on there. It's the same man.
So tell me about more. I mean, one of the things that was of interest in your article was that Nick Lowles tweeted about an acid attack in, was it Middlesbrough or something, and then just said, oh, I was lying, but it was good because it got publicity. And it seems also... Also, the whole nonsense during the riots about there's going to be riots here, and they put it on the news, and then of course there's no such riots, and then they can claim that it's a victim for anti-fascism. It's this huge psychop that we were subject to just kind of calm the riots down. Tell me a bit about the legal issues there.
So the tweet in question, which has often done the rounds, is that a Muslim woman had been attacked with acid in Middlesbrough that Lowles put out in August. And totally unverified, the next day, after checking with the relevant police force, Lowles issued an apology and clarified that that had never happened. Then later had suggested that while it had never happened, as you rightly say, it was for a good cause, which I think ties into this sort of the underpinning of a lot of organizations that say we're anti-fascist, that is our purpose. We have lied to the public and we have now issued an apology about lying, but it was all for a good cause because the ends justify the means. In that instance, I don't believe that the ends do justify the means, and it seems very strange that there is an asymmetry of how those riots were policed on the basis of various communities that were involved. For example, you ended up with sort of a retaliative, largely Islamic, portion of the population who wanted to engage in thuggery in the same way. And Lowles' tweet was, I'm sure, in little part responsible for that, but was immediately passed off as couldn't be the case. That asymmetry is beginning to look very suspicious. And again, I look to the Attorney General on that one as somebody who has openly sympathized with this very organization as to whether prosecutions or charges were brought and then failed to make it through that stopgap that the Attorney General has for stirring racial hatred, which, as the Public Order Act stands, does include, for the time being, essentially people who are of a different faith, a faith that may have a corollary in a sort of racial makeup.
Isn't that in that context, though, in law, to assert that in a tense environment like that, in which there is speculation that Ruta Cabana was Muslim or whatever, and it's like shouting fire in a crowded theatre when there's no fire, isn't it? I mean, it's if you're lying about it, you're deliberately, knowingly stirring up public disorder if you're going to tweet something like that and it's not true. And wasn't there a woman, in fact, that was prosecuted for tweeting during the Ruta Cabana riots that the killer was a recent boat arrival, you know, Muslim or something? I understand that she was prosecuted for that, unless I remember incorrectly.
A variety of people were prosecuted under Section 4, 4A and Section 19 of the Public Order Act for suggesting similar things that did not amount to direct incitement. I don't believe that Lowles' account of that happening was a call to direct incitement. But I also don't believe that, for example, Lucy Connolly's highly publicized tweet where she said, "I don't care if you do this," is direct incitement either. So there's the asymmetry. These things are perfectly capable of leading to a breach of the peace, but I believe there should be a direct link between a physical breach of the peace at a time and a place that is linked to a piece of speech contained on a Twitter account. I don't see personally why there should be anything less in terms of the burden of proof on why that person should be implicated in a piece of violence. So I don't think Nick Lowles or Lucy Connolly should be in prison, is my point. But as it stands, there is an asymmetry in the way that Section 19 of the Public Order Act is applied, which tends to be that even if you don't mention Connolly's tweet is an excellent example of this, because she doesn't outwardly incite violence at a specific place. She says, "I don't care if." Either Lowles or Connolly outwardly incited violence. Connolly's tweet as a case study in that it is a good one, because she says, "I don't care if," with respect to it's specifically burning hotels. There isn't a specific location, nor is there a specific target group associated with doing, you know, not caring if that is done. But this was all deemed to be stirring racial hatred by Section 19, despite never mentioning the specific racial group or necessarily outwardly stating that there should be a specific action. Lowles is also suggests that there's ongoing unrest and something should be done about it, essentially. And I don't believe either of these meet a test for direct link between the action and the motivation stemming from words committed to Twitter. And without that, I don't believe any of these prosecutions should be being brought. Otherwise, we are quite literally in the realm of suggesting that, oh, well, that might have done something, or given the timing of the statement, and I used this example in previous writing, if you were to see the first tower be hit in New York City by a plane, and you were to tweet, by standards of current British law, if you were to then, after seeing that, tweet, "Well, I don't care if the second tower is hit," that would be a criminal offence under the Public Order Act of 1986. And you could stand to get up to 31 months in prison with no priors and a humble family life outside of tweeting that. That is an absurdism. That is an absurdism to suggest that without a direct link between the action of that second plane hitting the tower and your tweet being made, that this would have any bearing on that the criminal law should concern itself with. It's an almost pre-crime at that stage.
Yes, you looked at this in the article. I recall that concept. So, what else then? Have they done which skirts the borders of the law, or is seemingly? I mean, we know, as I understand it, Jerry Gable, who is one of the founders of Searchlight, has done things like broken into people's houses, hasn't he? Is that not what you said in the article?
Burglarizing people, this is the thing that I think leads most observers to, once they discover it, to think this is quite Secret Service type activity, going through bins, burglarizing people in the attempt to acquire or fabricate information about somebody. And conviction for that in the case of Gable, who is the mentor to Nick Lowles, and Searchlight, which Gable founded, is the predecessor to Hope Not Hate. So there's a continuity in these kind of deliberate skirting of the law actions, intimidation of people, not necessarily burglarizing people, but certainly coercing and bribing and blackmailing both the individual and previous associates unbeknownst to them. And we've got plenty of fairly recent examples of that. There was a chap called Morgoth, whose name I won't repeat, but whose identity was revealed by them, who reported basically various neighbors and associates being harassed through consistent courses of behavior by people, likely from Hope Not Hate, posing as investigative journalists, sometimes posing as authorities to extract information. And this is as recent as a few months ago. So there's a clear pattern and a continuity between Searchlight, which was bankrupted over libel, by the way, should be said. There's a clear pattern of behavior, and the quality of the outcomes of that behavior and the information that they get hold of, then somebody needed to say something about it. That is the purpose of the article. I do encourage everyone to read it. It is frightfully long, and it is catalogue-like in every allegation we could find against them that we could find a source for.
Yes, and one of the things that they do is, so for example, when it was my case, I was written to by The Guardian with various lies that have been put on about me on a site, a particular website called Rational Wiki, which they idiotically used as a source. And I simply refuted every single one of them. And then they weren't, that was it, that was not republished. Now, with Searchlight, I wasn't going to bother responding to their email. Mm-hmm. So they then just continued to publish these lies, like that I was sacked from Olu University, things like this, completely untrue. And I wonder on what level they hope to kind of get away with this, because you think that they won't be taken that seriously because they're partisan. But the problem is that then other newspapers take them, newspapers, proper sources, take them seriously.
It's a Chinese whispers type thing. They rely upon weak sources frequently in the hopes of generating more sources in their own reports, in the hopes of then passing that to publications that are more reputable, in the hopes that they won't check it. Which, you know, journalists in this country, it would be very good if they could do some journalism at some point, but the likelihood of them checking a source before passing it off as a credible one is fairly low. And Hope Not Hate seems to know this and rely upon it and rely upon the reputational damage it causes. And it's something that they have been in court over during the Searchlight years, but it's something that they continue to do in the digital age, where that is all the more easy to generate source upon source upon source, muddying the actual origin of the information. And when the origin of the information is either acquired coercively or is just pure conjecture, then after about five citations, it starts to become quite difficult to prove that. And I think they're counting on that.
What I find extraordinary is that even people on the right take them seriously to some extent. So the Reform basically used them to explore the backgrounds of their candidates and ban candidates who Hope Not Hate say are a problem, yet Reform claim to be in favour of freedom of expression and, you know, the opposite of Hope Not Hate and anti-woke and all this kind of thing. And the Telegraph gave the TV programme that relates to the Year of the Rat a positive review. A positive write-up. It seems to be the most peculiar relationship there with even the right, with even the conservatives. And this is a group that put Rishi Sunak in their State of Hate report.
Well, like with journalists, if they could do some journalism, that would be great. The Conservative Party, if they perhaps could field some Conservative candidates, that would be great. But putting Rishi Sunak in a State of Hate report is quite an absurdism to anybody who is awake to the world and the lie of the land in the political landscape. Why on earth Hope Not Hate had a hand in vetting candidates for reform in any formal manner is beyond me. But they vet candidates for all parties, whether they have chosen to allow them to do so or not, because they can basically turn you into somebody who can't enter public life or who could be ejected from public life. And they're still vetting Reform candidates who've been elected to Parliament with James McDermott just this week. McMurdoch, sorry.
But why don't they just turn around and say, we regard you as a nasty, anti-British, hateful organisation, and we don't accept anything you say?
Why indeed? I think people should be able to speak truth to power, and I think people should be able to do so with the sufficient reach where their sources are credible to do so in a way that is useful to the public. However, this is clearly partisan targeted. But even Navarra Media and people on the left have criticized Hope Not Hate for the way they cherry-pick people and cherry-pick their targets. So there's a bipartisan understanding that they are up to something strange. A lot of our criticisms that we have used as sources in that article don't come from right-wingers. They come from people who you would regard certainly as left-wing. And that seems to be quite uniform across stuff. But why don't they just reject the moral authority of them is a very good question.
One of the things you raised in that article, which I thought was quite interesting, is, of course, they do attack people on the left if those people on the left also question their sacred cows, or these supposed sacred cows, because they're the uber-conformist narcissists that get a sense of importance out of being uber-moral and reinforce it via their behaviour. I understand them psychologically completely. But people like Galloway or Piers Corbyn are vociferously attacked in the Hope Not Hate report.
Well, I wrote a piece called England is Under Attack from All Sides and Within, which documented the way that specifically Parliament has been destroyed in three ways, with its deference upwards, its deference outwards to this quangocracy, and its deference downward to sort of local government that can do nothing. Hope Not Hate relies on a similar, it relies on the way the Blairite constitution is constructed, which means that where Parliament is toothless in that way and everything is regulated in this manner where you can only enter public life if you are quite okay with your sacred cows, everything is above board, you're essentially increasingly a nobody and your human attributes have been diminished to a very small amount. They're quite content with people of that variety, people who are, as I would call it, placeholder MPs or placeholder public figures. They're very content with that. And it's anyone who falls outside of that in their critiques or their line of questioning, even if it's proper, even if it's well-resourced, even if it's well-referenced, even if it's academic in its tone, they will try and make those people into cranks. And they will try and make people like Piers Corbyn into sort of untouchable freaks if they deviate even slightly from this comfortable middle. I've said in the past that when people say that elections are won from the centre, that is not true. Elections can only be conducted and parties can only be conducted because of the regulatory framework of things in law and organisations like Hope Not Hate. So elections have to be fought and battled in the centre, but that is not what the public would like. Not at all. And they're sick of it, I would say. This is my personal view on that. But Hope Not Hate is committed to making sure nobody deviates outside of that window at any time. The press are likewise bound by various codes, both broadcast and in print. The print stuff's voluntary, but the broadcast stuff isn't. And they're bound by everything from the Public Order Act down. One of the reasons we don't get reporting on the ethnicity of people after crimes is not just because of court reporting and prejudicing the trial. It is because it's baked in to the broadcasting code via Ofcom that you don't mention race in anything that could be construed as a disparaging manner. So we don't have anything to go off. And then when people suggest, why is that happening, without knowing that it's Section 13 and Part 3 of the relevant codes, without them knowing that and pointing the finger at that, Hope Not Hate will be there to say, you're a crank. You're a crank. Why would you even ask that? So my point is this, that there's an intricate system built to require governance from the centre on a permanent basis. And I call this the Blairite Constitution, and it is largely built up through legislation after 1997 and the creation of a large amount of quangos, quasi-autonomous government organisations, made in that same period and given powers in that same period. So Hope Not Hate relies on this situation and makes a living off basically just shooting any outlier, figuratively.
Tell me about the broader projects of which your Hope Not Hate article is a part.
So this is just one shot in the dark that it turns out has landed. But our broader project was to launch a publication that would take things that newsrooms wouldn't, make sure it's thoroughly referenced, scarily academic, and then put it out to the public in a way that makes the case for the thing in a definitive manner. I think, as Carl Benjamin said, very kindly, this is the definitive case against Hope Not Hate. We hope all our articles, by contributors or ourselves, will be the definitive view on whatever it may be. So that's part of the project that surrounds this article. We want to make an armory of really key resources, essays and otherwise, policy papers too, that people can refer to on a constant basis to say, right, I'll refer back to that. So an armory for the essentially the centre-right and really anyone who wants to use it to guide them in the correct direction with references to do so. And behind that, the back end of the thing is perhaps more interesting, is that I've assembled a team of people to ostensibly redraft a constitutional arrangement that befits the Englishman. And I do include the Irishman, Northern Irishman, Welshman and Scotsman in that, of course, but I'm an Englishman, the glut of the population falls into that category as well. And unpicking this booby-trapped Blairite constitution in its all of its legal sophistication is one of these sort of things everyone has on their lips, but nobody seems to be going about the business of doing. So we want to try and get about 6 to 7 bills. We've got one out, which deals with the quangocracy, and published a website with it, with all the information on what that entails. But we'd like to do a variety more with a team who is working on that presently, and publish that in The Restorationist also for anyone to use.
Restoration being an interesting title, because, of course, we had a period, the Commonwealth, which one might argue violently deviated from the traditions of English liberty and so forth, and then they had to be restored. And in the wake of that restoration, as I understand it, there was an act of oblivion, whereby all legislation under this period of deviance was struck off. Don't we need that? Don't we need basically anything after the 2nd of May 1997 is unacceptable and should be abolished, and we simply go back to what the law was on the 2nd of May 1997? Did we have essentially, in English terms, an illegitimate, deviant government, a government that was anathema to us, a period of going mad as a nation? The best characterized, I think, in Princess Diana's death and the insanity surrounding that.
Social hysteria, yes. That's an interesting one, perhaps for another time, with the death of Diana. But the huge uptick in legislative production after 97 is marked. I would go further than just that year, but it is a good benchmark. As some have put it, it would be like resetting a server to the last safe state in many regards. And yes, absolutely. That is required. And so, also, is it required with international treaties and things that are contingent on that period of legislation? People often talk about the Human Rights Act and the ECHR, which I have strong feelings on. And one thing that should be known is that after, for example, 1998, when that came into force, the Human Rights Act and domestic law, a great many other things were put in after it. A good visualizer for this is that if you were going to repeal the Human Rights Act, which does not give us human rights, we were perfectly capable of having liberty prior to that. It would be an absurdism to suggest that 1998 was the beginning of that point where we enjoyed those. Rather, it holds back and restrains every other constitutional machination after it as if it were a dam fit to burst. And by doing so, it justifies its existence because it is the only thing that restrains the various other tinkerings with our constitution from harming us even more. We're at the point where people have identified that even the dam is causing significant harm, self-harm, an autoimmune response to the ordinary man in this country. And what I'm trying to inform people with this is that we need to unpick the rest of that, as you quite rightly put it, rather illegitimate constitution that it is holding back at the same time as removing it. So it will be a series of legislation, or proposed bills. It would not be one great repeal act, as people like David Starkey have suggested. It is a booby-trapped constitution that we have had added onto our legal state prior to 1997.
Why do you think
and it requires unpicking like a bomb?
Why do you think we as a nation allowed this to happen?
Tony Blair was extremely popular. The idea of Americanizing our constitution was very popular. We were at the eve of globalism at its height, the absolute optimism for global markets and for this kind of approach to things. It was a radical change from eras gone by. And you know, right at that era of optimism, he's elected with a landslide. But the implications of it and the second order and third order effects of it are now clear. And
right,
he is
so
not particularly popular.
So you're saying basically at that time, and you're probably right, I infer you're a bit younger than me. I don't know how much you remember of this. But
Sure.
Where were you born?
Where was I born?
When?
Oh, I couldn't possibly comment.
Okay, well, the information is freely available on my website.
Yes.
I think you're younger than me. So there was an optimism. There was a positivity, and this isn't just me, you know, rose-tinted spectacles or whatever. People, even when I was at university in the early 2000s, there was a positivity about life. People were happy. Things were going to be good. There was that the Cold War.
Things could only get better.
Yeah, there was that feeling, and he articulated that so well. But he was surrounded by all of these bitter, angry, resentful people that have been locked out of power for 20 years. And their attitude was, we're going to come in and we're going to tear down everything we resent. And
well, it's
make
that sense
sure
of making it permanent as well.
They can never get
a similar thing. But like you say, they'd been locked out of power for a very lengthy period of time, and there was this impulse to, through constitutional reform, which is optimistic, positive, and a force of change in a positive sense, ostensibly. Through this, we can Trojan horse in an arrangement which requires you to permanently govern on our terms, which you can see in every subsequent government post Blair and Brown since then, and they've been constrained and even ousted by Blairite institutions. For example, both Liz Truss and Boris Johnson were both ousted by quasi-autonomous government bodies set up legally in the Blair and Brown years. We're now at the point that the permanence of that governance through institutions that are not elected and set up in that Blair era, parts of the Blairite constitution are now able to have an autoimmune response against the elected officials at the very top of things and set the entire agenda of how things will be conducted. So you're right to say it was optimistic and they'd been locked out of power, but they knew that they had to make sure that anyone subsequent to them were constrained to the variety of governance that they intended to move forward with. That is the purpose of the Blairite constitution.
Yeah, I've looked you up. You have no memory of when England was free.
No.
You are far too young. You have no memory. Zero.
Not at all.
One year old at the Great Change. I mean, you have no memory of it. Good heavens. You just get it from books.
But it's always good to get it from some kind of source, isn't it?
Well, yes. But I assure you, you would say, you'd see a chap on a park bench and you'd say, can I sit there? And he'd go, yeah, free country. And you wouldn't say that anymore.
No, that's an absurdism now, yes.
Going back to Hope Not Hate, finally, winding up, as it were, why do you think that – I get the impression that they are having to put people on short-term contracts, they have lost money, there's all kinds of stuff going on. What do you think has changed that there's a kind of movement against them, finally, these intimidating, evil people, that there's a movement against them now?
I think possibly in their selection of targets. They've selected less and less convincingly far right or fascist targets. They've now come to the point of preventing canasta clubs who have a right wing bent. You know, they're getting less and less convincing in their purpose, and therefore people have stopped listening. Not least, they have accrued a very great raft of sins in the process of doing so, which are now they're not big targets who are going to be jailed and were involved in some kind of plot to overthrow the government. It's just people who want to meet and have a chat. So quite right to say that a free country we are not, and Hope Not Hate is going after people in a way that is pretty clear to the ordinary man. The capital M normal man on the street does not see these people to be a threat. And he might be easily swayed, but only the press seem to be being swayed by their reports at this point. They've lost basically the mandate that they once had.
And equally, I suppose, one of the things that I think there's some evidence of a broader backlash against woke. And I suspect that might be because they've gone too far. If you make people guilty and bad for being a bit racist or sexist or even homophobic, they can cope with that. But if you start telling them that a boy is a girl and a girl is a boy, I think for a lot of people, that's just too much. They're just thinking you're forcing me to lie, and I'm not going to do it. And that seems to have turned, in my experience, anecdotally, with a lot of quite normal people who heretofore would say, "Oh, I'm extreme, you know, steady on it, don't rock the boat." But with that issue, they seem to have gone too far.
Attempting to compel speech that does not describe reality any longer is never a good avenue to go down. It unfortunately is pretty baked in by, like I say, the various forms of regulation that burden every single professional walk of life that you could be in. And just, you know, recent weeks and months, we've had various regulators saying, well, we're going to regulate things that are to do with your private conduct. We don't really care anymore. We're just going to do that, even though it has nothing to do with your professional conduct, your relevance to the profession. We're just going to come after you for things that are outside of that. So we shouldn't underestimate the ability to compel these behaviours and speech, even if you don't believe any of it, just to have a part in public life. But the tide is very much turning, and people are now realising we are certainly not a free country and would not say so on that basis. And Hope Not Hate, going beyond even the regulatory framework and beyond even the criminal framework, which are too expansive anyway, that's why they're losing their mandate. Nobody wants a furtherance of this sort of compelled speech or compelled silence on speech that does not seem to be suited or tailored to the country.
What would be concerning is if those people then start, because as happens when there's any kind of backlash or reversion or whatever, you know things are changing when the cowards start changing their opinions. So in 1995, you knew that something was in the air in terms of radical social change when the cowards start saying, oh, yeah, I was wrong to be racist in the 70s. Naughty me. I realized I was wrong, even though they were fervently racist in the 70s. And then you've got people now, oh, yeah, I was wrong about this trans thing, even though they were fervently saying that, you know, you should lose your job if you say that a woman can't have a penis or whatever. And now, oh, yeah, I made a mistake. When the cowards start moving.
That's a very good way of putting it. It's a good indicator for where the needle is heading, yes.
Yes. All right. Well, this has been most enlightening. So, chaps, you really should read How Long Can CPS Ignore the Criminality of Hope Not Hate? It is a fascinating, in many ways frightening, article about the state of Britain, that these people in that program you may have seen, chaps, present themselves as these hard, done by, scared, frightened little people who are just trying so hard to stand up for all that is good and kind, and the people say mean things about them, and oh my God. Whereas in reality, these are the enforcers, in my view, the enforcers in Nazi Germany, the enforcers in the GDR. You always get such people.
When you act like fascism is around every corner and in all the walls, then you start, generally speaking, firstly, acting like a paranoid freak, and secondly, start acting like a fascist.
Mm. As Jesus said, the spiteful mutants are always with us. Okay, thank you very much, chaps. I will see you all soon. And, yes, one more thing. So tell us, where can they find the Restorationist? They just Google that, do they? And that's where they...
So the Restorationist does come up with it. It's restorationist.org.uk. And you'll find a variety, an armory even, of well-referenced essays that would be of use to any Englishman.
Thank you very much, and goodbye!
Are you ready for the future of the West?